This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Film director Robert Altman has tried to bring some of the messiness and chaos of life into his movies. His films MASH, Nashville, and McCabe and Mrs. Miller broke new ground with their overlapping dialogue and scenes that grew out of improvisation. During much of the 70s, Altman was hailed as an American original, but by the end of that decade, he'd lost his popular following with the release of such films as Buffalo Bill and the Indians, A Wedding, and Health. 2 years ago, Altman gained wide critical acclaim for his cable TV series, Tanner 88. He joined forces with Doonesbury's Gary Trudeau to create a TV series for HBO that followed fictional candidate Jack Tanner as he ran for president in the 1988 Democratic primary. Now back on the widescreen, Altman is receiving rave reviews for his new film, Vincent and Theo, which is about painter Vincent van Gogh and his relationship with his brother Theo. Even though this is a biographical film, Altman says he didn't want to take on the responsibility of having to reflect historical truth.
I did not want to make one of those biographical films. I don't like those films, and I don't believe them. And I almost didn't make this picture because of that, because I think it's a big obligation to come out with a film about that has Vincent van Gogh in it, and people expect all adulation and profit. But I just try to set about my vision of this man and his brother as failed people, really.
Failed human
Not
beings?
As successful artists, failed human beings.
So what liberties did you decide it was okay to take with history, with the truth?
Well, we used most of the things that there were actual facts about, which, that he did cut Mutilady's ear a little bit, and then he shot himself, and there are certain dates where things were recorded. But you have to remember that at the time he lived, nobody had any inkling at all that he was going to be a successful anything. So people weren't running around, making notes on what happened. So the only evidence is hospital records and things like that. And then people who knew people who knew people. But
what about the letters?
I take the position that his letters were, most of them were works of art in themselves. They weren't it's like his self-portraits. He didn't look like any of those self-portraits necessarily. He did maybe 400 self-portraits, but the letters I think are have their own purpose for the letter writer. And as far as getting evidence, factual evidence out of letters, only half of them were there. I mean, I have to assume that Theo wrote him once in a while. They didn't have any telephones.
You know, I'd never seen the 1956 Vincent Minnelli movie about Van Gogh, Lust for Life, so I ran out and rented it after I saw your movie. And
yeah.
I thought that it was really a study in contrast. You know, the Minnelli film has lots of dialogue. Everything is explained, both about Van Gogh's painting style and about his motivation. And Vincent van Gogh, at least in the first half of the movie, is much more likable. He has more energy and enthusiasm. He's more vigorous and outgoing. In your movie, Vincent is remote. He's unreachable. He's joyless. He rarely speaks. He's physically unattractive, not in his bone structure, but he has food and dirt between his teeth. You can tell he probably smells and that he probably doesn't take care of himself physically. And he's driven to paint, but you don't know what's going on in his mind at all.
Well, I think he had a demon. I think like all artists have a demon, have demons. They have something compels them to do what they do, and it's very painful when it's not accepted. But that's the way he was. He was a beatnik, if you will. He rebelled against the social standards of his family and the. And, he came from, there was a very wealthy family he came from. His uncle was the admiral of the port of Amsterdam, and another uncle owned probably the largest, most successful art galleries in London and in Paris, the Goupils. And the other uncle was a bookseller, and they were all church people in the Dutch Reformed Church. They were pastors. And his father was a sort of a black sheep. He was a a pastor of a small church in Holland, in Noonan, and a couple of other little towns. He just rebelled. He wouldn't eat in a restaurant if they had a tablecloth on the table, because he thought that was highfalutin. That's the general information that we had, and that's the position that I took to show in the film.
Did you, in your own way, set out to do the opposite of the Minnelli movie? Did you see your film as a contrast?
No, I saw the Minnelli movie when it first came out. I'm sure. I just remember its existence. I don't remember any details of it, and I purposely didn't see it when I got ready to make this film. I just didn't want to be influenced pro or con by it, so I didn't deal with it.
I feel like in your portrayal, you've made Vincent van Gogh not only misunderstood, but kind of unlikable and very selfish. Was that your impression of him in reading about him?
Well, I think in the letters. I mean, I read. I didn't study those letters, but I didn't read all of them. But every letter I've read, somewhere, whether it's between the lines or actually on the page, in the letter to Theo is, "Where's my money? Where's my allowance? Don't forget to send the cash." You know, and I think that was a one reason for the letters. Letters are you know, one side of a debate. You put down, you write a letter. I write a letter, and I write the information I have to get across. But then, if I'm going to philosophize in the letter or talk about personal things, I'm talking about what I want the person who's reading that letter to believe. And I just don't trust I don't think that he sat down and purposely lied, but I think that those letters, I'd like to see Theo's letters, and had I had them, I might have had a different approach to the film. Were you offended, or did you object to the way that we portrayed Vincent?
Oh, it's not that I objected to it, and I know so little about Van Gogh's real life. I have no idea what's, like, historically faithful to the painter and what's not. I guess one thing I felt was perhaps missing was a sense of Vincent Van Gogh's internal life, because he's so remote. He's remote not only from the people, from the other characters in the film, from the people in his life, but I felt he was a little remote from me, that I didn't always have a sense of what went on in his mind, whether he was insane the whole time or whether he was just antisocial and self-involved. I thought perhaps with all the letters he left, there might have been a way to work in a little more of what his internal life was like, what his thoughts were like.
Well, I think his internal life was, that's the character I wanted to show. That's the character I wanted to show you, and that's the way we chose to do it. I mean, and my view, it's certainly not factual, because nobody knows what the facts are.
Yeah.
I mean, there aren't very many people that know much about him. Everybody that wrote about him, other than his letters, Gauguin wrote some letters, Emile Bernard, there was some mention of him in letters, and he was just not a very likable man. But he was driven to the point and was extremely noble in that fact, that he stayed at that for so long. And nobody, you must remember, nobody ever smiled at him. Nobody ever looked over his shoulder at what he was doing and said, "Oh, that's great. I'd like to take that home to my aunt," or "keep up the good work." I mean, he just didn't get any recognition and was dead and buried a long, long time before he did. And then the letters became, of course, a part of that, and the dramatic issues, incidences of his life. And then suddenly he's selling paintings. His last painting sold for $82 million. I mean, it's absurd.
Robert Altman is my guest, and in his new movie, Vincent and Theo, is about the Van Gogh brothers. I could say it like it sounds like a vaudeville team, you know?
Well, maybe they were.
I remember when I interviewed Keith Carradine earlier this year. He was telling me about his audition for you, and he said it was this, like, weird audition. You didn't have him do any scenes or anything. You looked at him, you spoke to him, and you hired him, if I remember the story correctly. How do you audition actors? And I should say this in the context that in your new movie, the stars of the film are actors who won't be known to most Americans.
Well, I hope they'll be known after the film.
Yeah.
Because Tim Roth and Paul Rees, all of them, the two boys are British actors, and then all the Dutch characters were played by Dutch actors speaking English, and all the French characters were played by French actors speaking English. And when I audition, I don't read scenes, have people read. I'm not usually the kinds of films I make are not dependent on that the dialogue be. Is not the most important part of what their obligation is. I try to get a feeling for the person themselves and what they're seem capable of and how they approach a project or a character. And I rarely have I had sat down and had someone read a scene for me. So Keith, I guess, was when I hired Keith from McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Keith Carradine, he came to see me, and I suppose he was a young actor then and just starting. I don't think he'd done very much. And he was trying to, he was used to going on interviews where they sat down and gave him a script and said, read this part. And I just didn't do that, so I think that probably stuck in his mind.
Yeah, I have this image of the director wanting to see how a camera sees an actor, how an actor looks on screen, which is often very different from how they look in real life. Can you see that in your head without
well,
having to actually shoot
that's
the person?
My eye, that's what I do. I mean, I kind of, that's what my job is to be able to anticipate that. I've been wrong, but not very often. I mean, I know of actors that started and had never worked. It was the same way Jeff Goldblum, Keith Carradine, Michael Murphy, Shelley Duvall, Cher. God, there's an endless number of people who have more or less started in films of mine, and I don't think there's any case where I actually read them. I just don't know how to do that.
Does an actor have to be a certain kind of actor to work with you?
Yeah, I think so. I have had times where I have worked with actors who I know are good actors. I mean, really good actors, because I've seen their work on film or on stage. I've seen what they can do, and I hire them, and this doesn't happen often, but it has happened, and suddenly I realize I'm talking to them, we're ready to do a scene, and I realize they don't understand, they're not getting it. We're on a different communication track. They don't understand what I'm saying, and they're frustrated, and they don't do well. And I don't know what to do about that when that happens. It's just a shame, because it's as much my fault. It's not their fault. It's half their fault. But it's just, you know, we meet people in the course of our lives that we just don't connect with for some reason, and we can't explain it, but there's some reason we don't understand one another, and that happens occasionally.
I'm thinking too of do you feel you can work with an actor who likes to do lots and lots of takes and have a precise performance, something precise in their head? Because I know you like to do a lot of scenes that are part improvised, that are comparatively loose, and that just might not work with a character who wants to keep doing it till an actor who wants to keep doing it till they get it just right.
Well, but the question is, what is just right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whose decision is what is just right? The most extreme example I've had of that, what you mentioned, was in McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Warren Beatty is an actor who. He was wonderful in that film. I just, I can't imagine anybody being better. But Warren has to, he would still be doing takes if people would stay there and shoot it. He doesn't start rehearsing until the third or fourth take. You have to run film through the camera, and he's kind of, it's like putting his toe in the water, and then his foot, and then he's up to his thigh. He tests it until he finally gets very, very comfortable. Well, that's fine if you have the time and money to do that, But in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, most of the scenes he was doing, we were working with Julie Christie, who, on the contrary, likes to do it in one take, and she'll do another one. But she, you can actually see that she starts losing her concentration or her confidence as the repetition goes on. So I had a big problem. I mean, Warren kept getting better, and he does get better, and Julie kept losing it. So where do you stop?
So what'd you do?
Well, I stopped in what I always considered was the middle.
So probably nobody was happy, right?
Yeah, well, there was frustrations.
Mm-hmm. Do you think of any of your movies as artistic failures? Are there any that you've made that you're unhappy with looking back?
No. And I say that because it's kind of arrogant, but I don't have... The only film that I don't recommend to someone who has some that thinks they may want to see it, I did a portion of a film called Aria. A bunch of film directors did little opera, I guess opera videos, and they were put together, and I did mine, and what I did was all right. But the way the whole piece was put together, I thought was, I'm sorry I did it. But all the other films are exactly what we set out, we meaning the collaborative artists that were involved in it. They're all what we set out to do. And whether a thing works commercially or not really doesn't have much to do with it. I mean, that's a matter of luck, time. There's certain films I've made that have failed at the box office and failed with the critics, and I understand why. But some of those same films have a cult following, and there's people who love them. Timing has a lot to do with it. We made Buffalo Bill and the Indians with Paul Newman. It just came out at a time. I think it's a wonderful film, and we won the Berlin Film Festival. We got a lot of accolades on it, but the audience, American audience, didn't like it very much, and just didn't go see it because we were spoofing an American hero. It was a rather hard look at it, and actually what we were satirizing was show business itself. But that came out at the bicentennial year when Nixon had just resigned, and nobody in America felt very good about themselves because most of them had voted for Nixon, and they felt like they're the ones that had been caught and been made a fool of, as indeed they had. So they weren't much thrilled when we came out on July 4th on the bicentennial day and said, come and look at another American hero that is, we're laughing at.
I know you were living in Paris for a few years.
Yes.
Are you still there, or have you moved back to the States?
I have a car with a telephone in Paris, and I've given up my apartment. I'm back here now. I may go back to Europe, but I don't own any... I don't keep a house there or anything. My office is in New York, and I have an apartment in New York, and I have a little apartment out here in California, and I kind of split my time between the two.
So what does moving back to the States signify?
Nothing. It's just I fiddle on the corner where they throw the coins. It's where I can get a job.
Does it mean you're able to get more work in the States now than you were before?
No, I'm not doing very well at all, which is why I'll probably go back to Europe. It's a lot easier for me to work in Europe than here. There's a different attitude. It's not blatantly as commercial or openly as commercial here. Here, all the films that people want to make are films that are to serve an existing marketplace. That's why you see all the numbers after the titles. 2, 3, 4, 6, sequels, because everybody's trying to find what it is that people want to see and give it. And I think that in an artistic medium, if there is any art left in this, the artist should do something, and then it should be exposed, and people either respond to it or they don't. But I think we've made too much of a business out of it. I don't think the audience now gets generally gets a true someone's true feelings or inspiration about a subject. And in most cases, it's tested, and they say, oh, they like this kind of an ending, they don't like that kind of an ending. And I can't really concern myself about what it is, what kind of an ending it likes. You seem to show some disappointment or dissatisfaction in the way I presented Vincent, because he wasn't made to be attractive, or I didn't show you what went on inside of his mind. Well, this is the way I chose to show it. Many people, and you're not wrong, and I'm not wrong. That this is just what this is. Many people have quite the opposite reading on it. Mostly artists, for instance, people who do paint and who make their living at it, or in that business. Most of them are really feel this film is an accomplishment, and I'm thrilled with that. Other people have the feeling that you have when they say, "Oh well, it was that he wasn't." I didn't learn enough about him, and I wasn't trying to do. It wasn't a training film. You understand?
Right. Yeah.
But that's not to say that you're wrong, or I made a film called Quintet with Paul Newman that nobody liked. I mean, it was really a failure. That picture lost money, not a lot, but it did. And yet in Europe and in the United States, there are little cult groups that just, that's the movie. So, and as long as I can find that cult, and a cult, you understand, it's not enough people to make a minority. that pleases me, because that's what I'm trying to do, is just show, hey, look at it this way. This may not be the truth, this may not be, but this is the way it appears to me.
In 1988, you did a series for cable called Tanner 88, and you had your own candidate, played by Michael Murphy, who went to all the places of the primary elections and campaigned, and there were real consultants who who consulted with him on camera.
Yeah.
Do you have a sequel planned?
Well, we're talking to Tanner about running in 1992. Gary Trudeau is my partner in this, and we're willing. We'd like to run Jack again. We're trying to encourage him to want to run. I just don't know that we're going to get enough. You know, we need some campaign contributions. And Jack is a very funny guy. He wouldn't take any money the last time from Keating and those people. So we may not get it. But chances are we'll be running Tanner in 92. I think that we need to.
Robert Altman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.